the borrowed pistol, then slid it back into my purse. For a second, none of the family moved, and my plans had not gone beyond the speech, so I just kept my hand in my purse, fondling my security. Jerry spoke. Okay, I understand, but for a mother, I must say you a mean motherfucker. Come on, Susie. They turned and, huddling together, walked back toward the rear of the house. I spent a few more minutes talking to Mrs. Tolman about the trip and the weather. We parted without mentioning my son, her granddaughter, or my trim Beretta, which lay docile at the bottom of my purse. In the meantime, Revolution had accepted my short story. That it would appear only in Cuba and probably in Spanish did not dilute the fact that I was joining the elite group of published writers. The Harlem Writers Guild celebrated. Rosa Guy, a founding member, who had been in Trinidad when I joined the group, had returned and offered her house for the week's reading and a party in my honor. I made my way through the busy streets of Harlem, dressed in my best and wearing just enough makeup. I was en route to the Southern Christian Leadership Conference to meet Bayard Rustin. I had seen him a few times at fundraising parties since the closing of Cabaret for Freedom, but we had not had a private meeting since the first time in the organization's offices, and I imagined a thousand reasons why I had been asked to return. The receptionist told me Mr. Rustin was waiting. He stood up and leaned over the crowded desk, offering me his hand. He said, "Maya, thank you for coming. Have a seat. I'll call Stan and Jack." I sat and ran through my mind all the possibilities. There was a discrepancy in the figures from Cabaret for Freedom. They wanted me to produce another review. They needed volunteers. Stan and Jack came in smiling. That could mean that the receipts had been okay, but I wasn't sure. We all shook hands, exchanged the expected small greetings, and sat down. Bayard said, "You speak first, Stanley." Stan Levison cleared the non-existent phlegm from his throat. "Oh, Maya, you know we're proud and pleased at the way you handle Cabaret for Freedom. We think you've got administrative talent." It was Jack's turn. "We are sorry to say that Bayard is going to be leaving the SCLC. I looked at Bayard. His long, handsome face was lined, and his eyes appeared troubled. He said, "I'm going for a short rest. We're looking around for someone to take my place. I suggested that you were capable." Only shock, which held me vise-like, prevented me from jumping up and running out of the office and down the street. Take Bayard Rustin's place? He had worked for the Quakers, led marches in Washington, D.C. during the 40s, had been to India and worked with the Untouchables. He was educated, he was famous, and he was a man. I didn't say anything because I couldn't speak. Stanley said, "When Bayard came up with your name, we were quite surprised, but we've thought about it and come to an agreement. You're the person we would all like to run the office." I blurted out stupidly, "I can't type." The men laughed. I could have kicked myself for giving them the chance to patronize me. Jack said, "You will have a secretary to do your typing." He laughed again, "and answer your telephone." Bayard told me, "If you take the position or if you refuse it, I'm leaving. Take it. You'll do a good job." At the SCLC, the telephones rang constantly, and the office swirled with activity. After 6 months as coordinator, I knew how to contact reliable philanthropists, the first names of their secretaries, and which restaurants the donors used for lunches. I carried a briefcase and sat on subways, sternly studying legal papers. Martin Luther King was sacred, and fundraising was my calling. Days were crammed with phone calls, taxi rides, and serious letters reminding the mailing list that freedom was costly and that a donation of any amount was a direct blow against the citadel of oppression which held a helpless people enthralled. After a day of such heart-stirring acts, I would travel back to my apartment, somewhere after sunset, and before I reached Brooklyn, the glorious magic disappeared. When I stepped off the subway at Park, I was no longer the bright young woman executive, dedicated to justice, fair play for Cuba, and a member of the Harlem Writers Guild. I was an unmarried woman with the rent to pay and a 15-year-old son who had decided that anything was better than another dull evening at home with mother. Secretly, I agreed with him. Tony's restaurant and bar on nearby Sterling Place became a sanctuary. It was not so dull that it attracted church-going families exclusively, nor was it so boisterous as to promise company combined with danger to unescorted women. The big man and I had noticed each other several times, but although he was always alone, he had never spoken to me. One evening I walked into the bar and settled myself on a corner stool. Teddy served me my first drink and called me the Harlem Girl Friday. Then the man called from his stool at the bar's extreme end. He said, "Hey, bar, that one's on me." Teddy looked at the man, then at me. I shook my head. Teddy didn't move, but his eyes swung back to the man, who nodded, accepting my refusal. Accepting the first drink from a strange man is very much like a nice girl having sex on a first date. I sat waiting for the second offer. The man said, "My name is Tom, Maya. Why won't you have a drink with me?" I said, "I don't know you. A lady can't drink with a nameless man." He was a reddish-tan color, which southern blacks call Marini. His face was freckled, and his smile a blur of white. He said, "I'm Thomas Allen. I live on Clark off Eastern Parkway. I'm 43 and unmarried. I work in Queens, and I work hard, and I make pretty good money. Now you know me." He raised his voice. "Bar, give us another one like that other one." Then he dropped his voice. "Tell me, why are you all alone? Have the men gone blind?" Although I knew it was an expected move in the courting game, flirting made me uncomfortable. Each coy remark made me feel like a liar. I wiggled on the stool and giggled and said, "Oh, stop." Thomas was smooth. He led, I followed. At the proper time, he withdrew and I pulled forward. By the end of our introductory ceremony, I had given him my address and accepted an invitation to dinner. We had two dinner dates, where I learned that he was a bail bondsman and divorced. I went to his house and received lavish satisfaction. After a few nights of pleasure, I took him home to meet my son. We enjoyed each other's gifts and felt easy together. I had only one regret. We didn't talk. He never introduced a subject into our evenings and answered with monosyllables to any questions asked. After the most commonplace greetings, our conversations were mostly limited to my shouting in his bedroom and his grunts at my dining room table. He treated my work at the SCLC as just another job. The Writers Guild had met at Rosa's apartment, and people were arranging rides to a late-night party in Harlem. I declined, saying Thomas was coming to take me home. Someone suggested I bring him to the party, but before I could respond, another writer asked if it was true that fellow was a bail bondsman. "He was a bail bondsman, so what?" The woman said, and hunched her shoulders. "Well, I hope you're not getting serious with him, because he sure as hell wouldn't be welcome in my house. They're as bad as cops, living on poor folks' misery." I had no time to think of the consequence of what I was going to say. The woman, of course, was not my friend, but even a polite acquaintance would not have tried to embarrass or challenge me in public. "I'm marrying him," I said. "I'm tearing up your invitation to the wedding." Rosa, who knew all my secrets, widened her eyes and asked, "Since when?" I dealt with all the questions with a coolness I didn't feel. It was true that Thomas had not asked me to marry him, and Guy had no special regard for him. I knew I wasn't in love with him, but I was lonely and I would make a good wife. When I told Thomas that I wanted to get married, he nodded and said, I've been thinking about that myself. I guess it's time. Guy accepted the news gravely. After a few moments of silence, he said, I hope you'll be happy, Mother. Thomas gave me an engagement ring and said we'd marry in 3 months. We would be married in Virginia, his home state, in the church where his parents were married. Then we would drive to Pensacola, Florida, because he always wanted to fish in the Gulf of Mexico. Guy would stay with his family while we were away. Obviously, he didn't require my agreement since he didn't ask for it. The decision to marry me automatically gave him authority to plan all our lives. I ignored the twinge which tried to warn me that I should stop and do some serious thinking. One Monday morning, Hazel Gray, my assistant at the SCLC, told me that over the weekend she had heard a South African freedom fighter speak. He was so thorough and so brilliant that even the biggest fool in the world had to see that apartheid was evil and would have to be brought down. His name was Vusumzi Make. A few volunteers standing in the outer offices had also heard the speaker. They joined in the conversation with added compliments. The smartest and calmest African I've ever heard. Another said, a little fat but cute as he wants to be. Another said, reminded me more of Dr. King than anybody I've ever seen. I asked his name again. Hazel said she had written it down and that the man was in the United States to petition at the United Nations against South Africa's racial policy. I made a note to go hear Make the next time he spoke. John Killens phoned on Thursday morning. He said, Maya, if you're free tomorrow night, come over to my house. Grace and I have asked a few people over to meet Make. I said, I'm working late tomorrow night. He said, come any time. Before leaving for work the next morning, I woke Guy and asked him to go to John's for dinner and said I would meet him there at 9:30. I left the office a little early, and after John opened the door, I walked through the milling crowd of acquaintances and strangers to find Guy in the kitchen. He looked up and grinned. He said, he's going to knock you out, Mom. We talked a little. He's more brilliger than the slithy toves. Guy was working so hard to appear grown up. I was surprised to hear him use his favorite childhood phrase. I went to the living room, and John Killens introduced me to a small, trim, dark man. Maya Angelou, meet Oliver Tambo, a warrior from South Africa. Tambo shook my hand and bowed. John continued, and come here and meet Vusumzi Make, another South African warrior. Make's appearance surprised me. I had imagined him very tall and older. He was 3 inches shorter than I, and his baby face was surrounded by fat. He had broad shoulders and a wide waist, all encased in a beautifully cut pinstripe suit, and he was in his early 30s. He said, Miss Angelou, glad to see you. You represent the black hero, Martin King, as I represent the South African black hero, Robert Sobukwe. Hazel Gray has been telling me about you. If we had not met, I would have known you anyway. I've met Guy. His accent was delicious, a result of British deliberateness changed by the rhythm of an African tongue and the grace of African lips. I moved away after smiling, needing to sit apart and collect myself. I had not met such a man. He was intense and contained. His movements were economical and delicate. John and Grace corralled their guests back to the living room, where everyone found seats. After the chairs and sofas filled, people rested on footstools or wedged themselves between couches on the floor. John introduced Oliver Tambo, who talked about South Africa, the African National Congress, and its leader, Chief Albert Luthuli, in terse and controlled anger. We applauded the man and the cause that had brought him to the United States. Then John introduced Mr. Mackay, and my love no longer was in the hands of Thomas Allen. Mackay started talking from a seated position, but passion lifted his voice and raised him out of the chair. He had been a defendant charged with treason in the trials after the Sharpeville massacre. The Africans, the African National Congress, and Pan-African Congress members, along with people who belonged to neither organization, had met in 1958 to oppose oppression in that country. They had been inspired by Martin Luther King and the SCLC. Mackay looked over at me and nodded when he said that. They had been encouraged by Malcolm X and the Muslims to set themselves apart from their oppressors. When he finished, he asked for questions and was immediately satisfied. Which organization is the most popular in South Africa? Was he really flirting with me? When would the average South African become politically aware? Was he married? What could we as Black Americans do to speed along the struggle? How long was he going to stay in New York? Mackay turned. Doesn't Miss Angelo have a question? All attention shifted to me, and I shoved my real questions to the back of my head and asked, Mr. Mackay, would it be possible to solve the South African problem with an employment of nonviolence? He stood and walked to my corner. That which works for your Reverend King cannot work in South Africa. Here, whether it is honored or not, there is a constitution. You at least have laws which say liberty and justice for all. You can go to courts and exact an amount of success. He was standing over me, and I felt lucky, fortunate to be a Black American, and in comparison to him and his people, only slightly impaired by racism. I folded my arms and sat back as he used the time to develop his statement. He finished to standing applause and was wrapped round in seconds by a group of excited people. We caught sight of each other through the shifting bodies, but he never returned to my corner. After another drink, I went to collect Guy. My days started early, and Guy had his bakery job. At the door, Mackay stopped us. He said, Miss Angelo, just a minute. Guy, I would be honored to see your mother home. Mackay knew that asking Guy's permission would please us both. My son smiled, loving the old world formality, straight out of the Three Musketeers and the Corsican brothers. Thank you, Mr. Mackay. I am seeing her home. I could have pinched him until he screamed. Mackay said, of course. Thank you anyway. The big lunk almost bowed from the waist. He said, I hope we'll meet again, Miss Angelo. Good night. Good night, Guy. He walked away, and Guy and I went out the door. The American Society for African Culture had its annual black tie ball on Saturday night in the ballroom of a Midtown hotel, and as coordinator for the SCLC, I was expected to attend. Thomas was working late, so Rosa and her escort met me in Manhattan. The dance auditorium was filled with black women made up and coiffed and beautiful in Dior and Balenciaga gowns or in dresses run up by local seamstresses. I saw Mackay coming across the dance floor like an ocean liner plying through tugboats toward a pier. He asked me to dance. He moved surprisingly well for his bulk, and his enjoyment of the dance made him seem less serious. He pulled me to him, and I felt the hardness of muscle under the layers of fat. He laughed. He said, you're afraid of me, aren't you? A big girl like you, an American sophisticate, frightened by a little black man from the dark continent. Why should I be afraid of you? He was still laughing. He said, maybe you think I'll think you are a missionary, and I'll eat you. I said, I don't think that. Anyway, if more Africans had eaten more missionaries, the continent would be in better shape. He stopped dancing and looked at me with approval. He said, Miss Angelo, you have every reason to be alarmed. I intend to change your life. I am going to take you to Africa. I drew my body straight and made my face uninviting. Mr. Maki, I'm going to be married in 2 months, so your plan is impossible. He said, I have heard that. But where is the elusive groom? I defended Thomas. I said, my fiancé is working. And what does that diligent man do? He was smirking. He knew the answer to his question. I said, he is a bail bondsman, and I'm going to see him after the dance tonight. Maki grabbed my hand and led me back to my table. He pulled out my chair, and after I sat, he leaned to me and whispered, I owe it to our people to save you. When you see your bloody fiancé, tell him I'm after you, and that with me every day is Saturday night, and I am black and I'm dangerous. He left, and my heart threatened to stop. I went home early and alone. Guy was asleep, and the house was cavernous. Thomas answered the telephone. Had I enjoyed the fancy dress ball? No, he was too tired to come and pick me up. No, I shouldn't call a taxi. After all, we'd see each other the next day. He was taking me to the movies. The next night, the movie was deadly boring. I got up on the pretext of wanting a soft drink. I sat in the lobby smoking and wondering what Maki was doing. Thomas headed the car toward his street. I don't feel like going to your house. Are you all right? It's not that time of the month, is it? I said, no, I just want to go home. I told Thomas we were living in exciting times, and that because of the United Nations, Africans and oppressed people from all over the world were making New York the arena where they fought for justice. He said, I haven't lost anything in Africa, and they haven't lost anything in our country. They can all go back where they came from, as far as I'm concerned. Anyhow, I get all the excitement I need in my job, and I don't want to hear about politics at home. It was a long speech for Thomas and a disastrous one for our relationship. I could imagine future aborted conversations when I would be silenced. Days, weeks, months would pass with neither of us going beyond small talk. The next day brought bouquets of mixed flowers and vases of red roses to cover my desk and make me feel like a desirable courtesan. The accompanying cards read, From Busumzi Maki, to Maya Angelou Maki. Thomas chose the same time to have wedding presents delivered. Young, shabbily dressed men hauled boxes up the stairs and deposited them in the outer offices, Tom to Maya. I opened the cartons to find an expensive record player covered in smooth leather and 2 pieces of matching luggage. It was a flattering present, but I couldn't dispel the idea that the set was stolen property. I refused Maki's daily invitations to lunch and declined Thomas's offer to visit his apartment. Confusion had me spread-eagled. I couldn't run, nor could I dodge. Thursday morning, I agreed to meet Maki for lunch, a few blocks from my office. I would explain to him why he had to accept my rejection. Maki stood as I entered. He wore yet another well-tailored suit and custom-made shirt. I didn't need to look at his shoes to know they were shining like new money. He began talking before I sat down. He was pleased that I had overcome my timidity. My coming showed I had courage, a virtue which we both knew was a prerequisite in the struggle. I couldn't focus on the menu, but we ordered lunch. He continued talking, and I ate food I could neither see nor taste. He had been jailed for political action in South Africa. When the government released him, the police took him to an isolated desert area near Southwest Africa and left him there, hundreds of miles from the nearest human beings. A city-bred man with no knowledge of open country, he had scrabbled over rocky ridges and found water. He pulled caterpillars from shrubs and ate them. He made a slingshot and killed small animals and ate them raw or cooked when it was safe enough to light a fire. Days passed when the only things he saw moving were the vultures that lazed high in the sky above him. He walked through South and North Rhodesia, making sparse contacts with revolutionaries he had heard about, who were themselves in hiding and on the run. He took his first breath of freedom when he crossed into Ethiopia. He said, "I was the first Pan-African Congress member to escape. But, Miss Angelo, when I left exile, without water or food, I intended to reach Ethiopia. When I knew I was coming to the U.S., I came with the intention of finding a strong, beautiful, black American woman who would be a helpmate, who understood the struggle, and who was not afraid of a fight. I heard about you, and you sounded like the one. I met Guy, and I was impressed with his manliness and intelligence, obviously your work, and then I saw you." He reached across the table and took my hand. "You are exactly what I dreamed on my long march, tall and clear-eyed, needing to be loved, ready to fight, and needing protection, and not the protection of a bloody bail bondsman." Oh, Lord, that reminded me. I said, "Mr. Mackey, I agreed to have lunch with you to tell you I am going to marry the bloody bail bondsman." He leaned his bulk back in the chair, and his face darkened and clouded over with resignation. "You are breaking my heart. I am an African with large things to do. I have left my father and mother in Joburg, and given the ordinary run of time, I shall never see them again. Unless the revolution takes place in my lifetime, I shall never see the land again. To an African, the family and the land. I need you. I want to marry you." I said, "I'm sorry." And God knew I meant that. I excused myself and went to the toilet. The little mirror over the washstand was vague with dust, but I looked in it and saw misery in sharp outline. If I went through with the wedding to Thomas, I would load our marriage with such disappointment the structure couldn't stand. Mackey needed me. I would be a help to him. And then Guy. Guy would have the chance to have an African father. There could be no greater future for a black American boy than to have a strong, black, politically aware father. Admitting for the first time a decision I had made at the fancy dress ball, I looked into the mirror and said I would accept Mackey's offer. Mackey stood again as I reached the table. I sat down and took the napkin in my hands. The words refused to get themselves in order. I said, "Mr. Mackey, I will marry you." His face broke open, a brown moon splitting, showing its white core. He said, "And I will marry you, Miss Angelo. I will make you happy. We will be known as the happiest family in Africa." He came around the table and pulled me to my feet to kiss me. I noticed the other customers for the first time and started to pull away. I said, "Mr. Mackey." He said, "No, don't be ashamed." He turned to the other customers. "She will marry me. She will marry me. Will you drink with us? Miss Angelo will marry me." All the diners put their forks down and their glasses down and applauded us. He said, "We are going to be married. You must not call me Mr. Mackey. I must be called Vus. Vus, I'm obliged to clear the matter up with Thomas." He said, "Yes, I agree, but when you talk to him, I must be present." I said, "Oh, no, I'll speak to him alone tonight." He said, "Shouldn't I come with you? It might be dangerous." I refused his offer. Talking with Thomas was my responsibility. He said, "Then I shall be the one to talk to Guy. I'm going to be his father. We must begin our relationship properly." He put me into a taxi headed for Brooklyn. Guy had rocks in his jaws and flint in his eyes. He had called the office and had been told that I had left early. He went to the Killens, and they had no news of my whereabouts. Thomas hadn't heard from me, and Paul Marshall didn't know where I was. He couldn't find Abby's number, so he chided me. It wasn't fair to insist that he be considerate and phone home if I was going to treat him with casual indifference. Now, three men were looking to me for proof of devotion. My son expected warmth, food, housing, clothes, and stability. Thomas wanted equilibrium also. He was looking for a nice wife who was a good cook and was neither so pretty or so ugly that she drew attention to herself. I tried his number. I had to tell him that he hadn't yet found his mate. He didn't answer the ring. Voos saw me as the flesh of his youthful dream. I would bring to him the vitality of jazz and the endurance of a people who had survived 350 years of slavery. At dawn, Thomas answered the telephone. He said he would pick me up from the office and collect the wedding gifts. We would stop at my house, and after dinner with Guy, we would go back to his apartment for a little you-know-what. The day jerked itself to evening in stops and starts. Time either wouldn't move at all, or it raced like a whirlwind. At last, and too soon, Thomas stood in my office doorway, smiling, showing his death-white teeth. "Hey, baby, where's the stuff?" I said, "Hi," and pointed him to the cartons against the wall. While I was saying goodnight to the office staff, he carried the gifts downstairs, and when I joined him on the pavement, he was loading them into the trunk of his car. At home, Guy watched television, and Thomas read the sports pages while I cooked dinner. I knew that but for my shocking plans, we were acting out the tableau of our future into eternity. We ate without excitement, and Guy said goodnight, going back to his room. Thomas rose to bring in the luggage, but I stopped him. I said, "I have some talk for you. Why don't we have a drink?" I began talking slowly and quietly. I said, "I've met a South African. The whites sent him out to die, but he survived. He has come to the United States, and he deserves our support." I continued my story, saying that the man was inspired by Dr. Martin Luther King and had come to petition the United Nations on behalf of his people. I used small words and short sentences, as if I were telling a fairy tale to a child. Thomas was not enthralled. I said, "A large conference is going to be held in London, where other people who have escaped from South Africa will meet and form a joint freedom-fighting organization." I balled up my nerve. This African I've just met has asked me to attend the conference. Thomas twitched his shoulders, raised his body an inch, and then slid deeper down into the chair. "I have decided to accept the invitation and to deliver a paper on Martin Luther King." The invention came as a wonderful surprise. I had been searching all day and during the preparation of dinner in vain for a way to say what I had to say, and nothing had come to me. "I don't know how long I'll be gone, but I may go to Africa after that." Thomas, in an unexpectedly fast move, sat up straight. He said, "You got another nigger." He hadn't raised his voice. All that shit was to tell me you got yourself another nigger. The moment I dreaded and had lied to avoid had arrived. "Say it. Say it in plain words. Say, Thomas," he mimicked my speech, "Thomas, I got myself another nigger. Say it." He was the interrogator and I was a suspect. I said, "Well, he's not a nigger. He's African, ain't he? Then he's a nigger just like me and just like you." He knew I loathed that word and didn't allow its use in my home. Now each time he said nigger, he sharpened it and thrust it, rapier-like, into my body. "Thomas," I forced a sweet calm into my voice. "Thomas, there doesn't seem to be anything more to say." The next afternoon I told Guy that the South African we had met at the Killens' house was coming around for dinner. He took the news so casually, I thought perhaps he had forgotten who Make was. He went to his room and began playing records as I fumbled, setting the table. When the doorbell rang, Guy popped out of the back room like a bottle cork and spun through the kitchen. "I'll get it!" Before I could set the stove burners to safe levels, I heard the rumble of voices speaking indistinguishable words. I reached the living room just as Voos was beginning to lower himself into Guy's favorite chair. He stood again, and we shook hands. I offered him the so much more comfortable sofa. Guy shook his head and smiled wanly. "This is comfortable too, Mom." I said, "Well, I'll go attend to dinner." Voos looked up. "Yes, Guy and I must talk." I continued preparing the prenuptial feast, assuring myself that Guy would take the news calmly. When I set the dining table, I consciously deadened my ears and hummed a song out loud. I was getting a husband, and a part of that gift was having someone to share responsibilities and guilt. They came to the table, and I saw from Guy's face that Voos had not told him of our marriage plans. We sat to dinner, and I ate straw. Afterward, I gathered the dishes, and when Guy rose to help me clear the table, Voos stopped him. "No, Guy, I must speak to you about our future, and I shall speak now. May we go into your room?" A shadow of panic rushed into Guy's eyes. He turned to me, peering, quickly trying to scan my thoughts. In a second, he collected himself. "Of course, please, come this way." He led the big man into his bedroom. After they entered, the door slammed. I made a clatter of dishes and a rattle of pans, slamming them together and jingling the flatware into cacophonous harmonies, trying to drown out my own thoughts and any sounds which might slide under Guy's door and slither across the kitchen floor and float up to my ears. Suppose Guy rejected the man and our plans. The kitchen was clean, every glass dried, and the dishes put away. I sat with a cup of coffee at the kitchen table, controlling the opposing urges to walk without knocking into Guy's room, or grab my purse and haul out the front door, running to Tony's and a triple scotch on the rocks. Laughter from behind the door brought me back to reality. Guy had accepted Voos, which meant I was as good as married and on my way to live in Africa. The next few days glittered as friends recovered from shock at my hasty decision, strung out a Mardi Gras of parties. At the end of the string of parties, Voos and I left for England, leaving Guy in the home of Pete and T. Beveridge, who lived a few blocks from my Brooklyn home. We sat on the plane holding hands, kissing, seeing our future as a realm of struggle and eternal victory. Voos said we would marry in Oxford, such a pretty little town. I explained that I wanted to have my mother and son present at my wedding and asked if we could wait. He patted my cheek and said, "Of course. In London, we will say we married in America. When we return to New York, we will say we married in England. We will have our wedding according to your wishes, whenever and wherever you say. I'm marrying you this minute. Will you say yes?" I said yes. He said, "Then we are married." We never mentioned the word marriage again. London's air was damp, its stone buildings old and gray. Colorfully dressed African women on the street reminded me of tropical birds appearing suddenly in a forest of black trees. Voos and I moved into a one-room apartment, which the Pan-African Congress kept near Finsbury Park. For the first few days, I was happy to stay in bed after Voos left for the conference. I read, rested, and gloated over how well fortune was finally treating me. Morning lovemaking and evening recitals lost none of their magic, but the time between the two events began to lengthen. When I told Voos that I was not used to having so much time on my hands, he said he would arrange for me to meet some of the other wives of freedom fighters attending the conference. Mrs. Oliver Tambo, the wife of the head of the African National Congress, invited me to lunch. The house in Maida Vale was neat and bright. but the sensation of impermanence in the large rooms was so strong that even the cut flowers might have been rented. She welcomed me and the other guests cordially, but with only a part of her attention. I didn't know then that all wives of freedom fighters lived their lives on the edge of screaming desperation. Ruth Thompson, a West Indian journalist, led the conversation as soon as lunch was finished. "What are we here for? Why are African women sitting, eating, trying to act cute while African men are discussing serious questions and African children are starving? Have we come to London just to convenience our husbands? Have we been brought here only as portable pussy?" I was the only person shocked by her language, so I kept my reaction private. A woman from Kenya laughed. "Sister, you have asked completely my question. We in Kenya are women, not just wombs. We have shown during Mau Mau that we have ideas as well as babies." A Mrs. Okalala from Uganda agreed and added, "At home we fight. Some women have died in the struggle." A tall, wiry lawyer from Sierra Leone stood. "In all of Africa," she said, "women have suffered." She picked at the cloth of her dress, caught it and dragged it above her knees. "I have been jailed and beaten. Look, my sisters, because I would not tell them the whereabouts of my friends, they have also shot me." She wore a garter belt, and the white elastic straps on her left leg evenly divided a deep gouged scar as slick and black as wet pavement. "Because I fought against imperialism." We gathered around her, clucking sympathy, gingerly touching the tight skin. "They shot me and said my fighting days were over, but if I am paralyzed and can only lift my eyelids, I will stare the white oppressors out of Africa." When the lawyer dropped the hem of her dress, all the women wrapped her round with arms, bodies, and soft voices. "Sister, Mother Africa is proud of you." Mrs. Tambo brought over a large bottle of beer. She said, "This is all there is in the house." The lawyer took the bottle with both hands and raised it to the sky. "The mother will understand." She turned and handed the beer to Mrs. Okalala. She said, "Auntie, as the elder, you must do the honor." I followed the general movement and found myself with the women bunched together in the center of a small living room. The woman faced us solemnly. "To talk to God, I must speak Lingala." She began to speak quietly, near a moan. Her tempo and volume increased into a certain chant. She walked around in rhythm and dribbled beer in the four corners of the room. The women watched her, accompanied her in their languages, urging her own, and she complied. I added amen and hallelujah, knowing that despite the differences represented and the babble-like sound of languages, we were all calling on God to move, and move right now. Stop the bloodshed. Feed the children, free the imprisoned, and uplift the downtrodden. The African women responded with tales of queens and princesses, young girls and market women who outwitted the British or the French or the Boers. I counted with the history of Harriet Tubman, called Moses, a physically small woman, slave, and how she escaped, how she stood on free ground above a free sky, hundreds of miles from the chains and lashes of slavery, and said, "I must go back. With the help of God, I will bring others to freedom." And how, although suffering brain damage from a slaver's blow, she walked back and forth through the lands of bondage time after time and brought hundreds of her people to freedom. When I finished my story, the African women stood applauding, stamping their feet, and crying, proud of their sister, whom they had not known. We agreed to meet often during the conference and share our stories so that when we returned to our native lands, we could take back more than descriptions of white skins, paved streets, flushing toilets, tall buildings, and ice-cold rain. A year would pass before I actually went to Africa, but that afternoon in Oliver Tambo's English apartment, I was in Africa, surrounded by her gods and in league with her daughters. The conference ended, and Vus had to go to Cairo on PAC business. He took me to London's Heathrow Airport and handed me a pile of English pounds. He said, "Find a good apartment in Manhattan and furnish it well. It must be large and central." I was unhappy at the prospect of going back to New York alone, but he assured me that he would return in 2 weeks, or at most a month. After he concluded his business in Egypt, he might have to go to Kenya. The thought of his exotic destinations cheered my spirit and strengthened my resolve. I was happy to return to New York, and the task of finding an apartment which would fit his exquisite taste. In 1 week, I found an apartment in Manhattan on Central Park West. I packed books, and I hired a mover. Guy spent the next few weeks adjusting to the new school, and I used the time seeing my friends and trying to beautify the apartment. Before Vus returned, I painted the kitchen and put brightly colored wallpaper in the bathroom. The apartment was crisp and elegant. He came home like a soldier returning from a conquered battlefield. His sagas of Cairo were heroic. He had drunk coffee with President Nasser and talked privately with his assistants. Egyptian officials supported the African struggle for freedom, and soon he would take Guy and me to live in Cairo. Excitement shook away Guy's just forming adult postures. He jumped up, wiggling. "We're going to Egypt? I'll see the pyramids? Boy, I'm going to be riding camels and everything." Vus chuckled, happy to be the cause of such elation. Guy finally took his thrills to bed, and I rushed into Vus's waiting arms. The next morning, my interior decorating met with stony disapproval. The old sofa was wrong for a man in my husband's position, and the second-hand store bedroom set definitely had to go. I am an African. Even a man sleeping in the bush will lay fresh leaves on the ground. I will not sleep on a bed other men have used. I followed him meekly around the furniture store, where he selected an expensive bed, a teak coffee table, and a giant brown leather sofa. He paid in cash, pulling bills from a large roll of money. The source of Vus's money was a mystery. He evaded my questions with the agility of an impala. There was nothing for me to do but relax and accept that he knew what he was doing. It seemed to me that I washed, scrubbed, mopped, dusted, and waxed thoroughly every other day. Vus was particular. He checked on my progress. Sometimes he would pull the sofa away from the wall to see if possibly I had missed a layer of dust. If he found his suspicions confirmed, his response could wither me. I was unemployed, but I had never worked so hard in all my life. Monday nights at the Harlem Writers Guild challenged my control. Heavy lids closed my eyes, and the best reading of the best writing could not hold my exhausted attention. Members of the South Africa United Front, which included the PAC, the ANC, and the South Africa India Congress, were invited to India to meet Krishna Menon. When Vus left, I fumbled around the house for a few days, seeing no one but Guy, trying to accommodate an uncomfortable sense of uselessness. When every window was polished and every closet as orderly as department store racks, I decided to go to Abby's house. The most called-upon prerequisite of a friend is an accessible ear. I said, "He doesn't want me to work, but I don't know what's going on, and it's making me crazy." Abby brushed the nap of her long-haired sofa. She said, "You wanted a man, Maya Angelou. You got one." She just didn't know how seriously upset I was. I said, "But, Ab, I didn't give over my entire life. You know that's not right." Abby made a clucking sound with her tongue and said, "The worst injury of slavery was that the white man took away the black man's chance to be in charge of himself, his wife, and his family. Vus is teaching you that you are not a man, no matter how strong you are. He's going to make you into an African woman. Just watch it." She dismissed the discussion and me. But she didn't know the African women I had met in London, or the legendary women in the African stories. I wanted to be a wife and to create a beautiful home to make my man happy. But there was more to life than being a diligent maid with a permanent pussy. Vus was back in New York, a little heavier and more distracted. He said the Indian curries had been irresistible, and his meeting succeeded, but raised new questions, which he had to handle at once. He was out of the house early and came home long after dark. We had not discussed infidelity. I had simply never thought of it. But the third time Vus's clothes were stained with the evidence of other women's makeup, I had to face the possibility. He came into the bedroom tying the belt of his silk paisley dressing gown. He said, "Dear, shall we go out for breakfast? I have a meeting downtown. We could go to Broadway and then..." "Vus, who is the woman? Or rather, who are the women?" He turned to me and dropped his hands to his side, his face as blank as a wooden slat. "Women? What women?" The round eyes, which I loved, were glazed over, shutting me out. "What stupidness are you talking about?" "The lipstick. It's fuchsia. It's not mine. This time the perfume is tweed. I have never worn that scent." "Ah," he smiled, stretching and opening his fine lips, allowing me a flash of even teeth. "Ah, my darling, you're jealous." He walked over and took my hands and pulled me up from the chair. He held me close, and his belly shook against mine. He was laughing at me. "My darling wife is a little jealous." His voice and body rumbled. He released me and looked into my eyes. "My dear, there are no other women. You are the only love in my world. You are the only woman I have ever wanted and all that I have." That was what I wanted to hear. But as a black American woman, I had a history to respect and a duty to discharge. I looked at him directly. I said, "Vus, if you fell in love with Abby or Rosa or Paul, I could understand. I would be hurt but not insulted. They are women who would not intend to hurt me. But love is like a virus. It can happen to anybody at any time. But if you chippy on me, you could get hurt. And I mean seriously." He pulled away. We were face to face, but he had withdrawn into his privacy. He said, "Don't you ever threaten me. I am an African. I do not scare easily, and I do not run at all. Do not question me again. You are my wife. That is all you need to know." He dressed and left without repeating his breakfast invitation. Despite the clash of cultures, Guy and Vus were building a friendship. My son was making a strenuous effort to understand the ways of Dad. They sat together laughing, talking, and playing chess. They were pleased with the dinners I prepared. But when I called their attention to the fresh flowers on the table or a new dress I was wearing, their reactions were identical. "How very nice, my wife. And lovely, Mom. Really very lovely." They treated me as if I were the kind and competent family retainer. At home, Vus read American, European, and African papers, clipping articles which he later copied and sent to colleagues abroad. He spent mornings at the United Nations, buttonholing delegates, conspiring with other African freedom fighters, and trying to convince the press that South Africa in revolution would make the Algerian 7-year war appear like a Sunday school picnic. He talked to everyone he thought influential, bankers, lawyers, clergymen, and stockbrokers. I decided to accept that the makeup which smudged his collars and the sweet aromas which perfumed his clothes came from brushes with the secretaries of powerful men. My controlled paranoia prevented me from realizing the seriousness of a phone call I received one morning. When I picked up the receiver, a man's throaty voice whispered, Mayamake, Vosumzimake is not coming home. The statement surprised me, but I wasn't alarmed. I asked, did he ask you to tell me that? Why didn't he call? Who are you? The man said, Vusumze will never come home again. He hung up the telephone. When I told Vus about the call, his face changed. He began chewing the inside of his bottom lip. His eyes were deep and private. He said, we must have the number changed. I'm surprised it took them so long. I didn't understand. He explained, that was someone from the South African police. They do that sort of thing. Telephone the wives of freedom fighters and tell them their husbands or their children have been killed. He grunted, I guess I should be insulted that they're just beginning on you. It indicates they have not been taking me seriously. He turned his large body to face me. He said, tomorrow I shall have the number changed, and I will step up my campaign. The telephone incident brought me closer to the reality of South African politics than all the speeches I had heard. That voice stayed in my ear like the inane melody of a commercial jingle. When I least expected it, it would growl, Mayamake, Vusumzemake will never come home again. The sheriff's deputies appeared armed and solemn at my apartment one winter afternoon. When they were assured that I was Mrs. Make, one man handed me a piece of paper while the other tacked a notice on the front door. I stood in the hall reading the form and then looked at the notice. We had been evicted for non-payment of the rent. We had to be out of the apartment in 24 hours or the sheriff's deputies would put our furniture on the street. Guy was still at school. Vus was at the United Nations. I calmly made a pot of coffee and sat down in the kitchen to think. I read the form again. I was holding the third and last notice, which meant that Vus had collected the other two and had said nothing to me. There was a frantic sound of the scraping of a key and the jerking open of a door. Vus and Guy arrived together. They crowded each other in the foyer. Guy spoke first. Mom, did you see this on the door? Vus came into the living room, followed by Guy. Have you spoken to anyone? He asked me. It was a strange question. I didn't know what he meant, so I shook my head. Vus asked Guy to please go to his room. For the first time in months, Guy studied my face. I nodded, and he went into his room reluctantly, but left his door ajar. Vus sat down with a heaviness which could not be credited to his bulk alone. His first statement struck me as being as strange as his first question. I have a lot of money, so there's nothing to worry about. In a few hours, we would be on the street. It was enough that we would have no place to sleep, but our address and telephone number would cease to belong to us. In fact, we were soon to lose everything which identified us to our community except our names. And Vusumzimake sat facing me saying, there's nothing to worry about. After a few minutes, he hauled himself out of the chair and picked up his briefcase. He opened the door, walked out, and eased it closed quietly. Vus returned after nightfall. He had arranged for the sale of our furniture, and a mover would arrive the next morning to take our personal belongings to a hotel where he had rented and paid for a furnished apartment. He had also started the ball rolling for us to go to Egypt. He delivered the news to me, but winked at Guy and cocked his head. Guy looked back at Vus with a blank stare and said, "That's great, Dad," and walked into his room. Vus went to Egypt to prepare a place for us, while Guy and I traveled to San Francisco. I needed to see my mother. I needed to be told just one more time that life was what you make it, and that every tub ought to sit on its own bottom. At the airport, she looked worn, although she was wearing too much nut brown powder, and the lipstick was so thick that when we kissed hello, our lips made a sucking sound. Her happiness at seeing me was brief. On the way home, she confirmed the suspicions which arose the moment I had seen her. She drove her big car poorly and talked about trifling matters. My mother was very upset. She settled Guy into his old room on the downstairs floor of the big Victorian house and asked me to join her in the kitchen. She began to talk over tall and strong drinks. She had sent me a photograph of her new husband. He was a dark brown, good-looking man, and she had raved about him in her letters to me. But as she talked now, seated at her kitchen table, I saw that the relationship was floundering, and she was straining every muscle to keep it afloat. She said, "He means well, baby.